thing of this world. Innocence is a fragile concept when death and destruction are but a mishandled sneeze away.
Yes, I totally understand, said Alison, with just a hint of irritation. But not every magic power is like that, right? Adam said a lot of them don't really do anything.
Such as?
He mentioned someone with a power that just makes their hair glow.
Indeed. But how could it be known that it wouldn't glow with the force of 1,000 suns, or emit deadly radiation, or turn all who gazed upon it into sea urchins? Only the secondary school can clarify these matters.
But you don't think that stuff they were doing in the yard, that was a little bit like brainwashing?
I should hope so, said Diablerie lowly. Washing is the correct thing to do to that which is unclean.
Without warning, the dense brush either side of the car cleared, and they were passing through the village of Bratton Fleming. A cluster of pastel semi-detached houses peered sleepily over rectangular hedgerows on the far side of a nicely maintained allotment. The tallest building in sight was a church bell tower in the distance, from which the staid silence of the English countryside seemed to radiate. The address Travers had provided directed them to a small terrace of four dwellings, all painted the insipid yellow of a banana milkshake. The Weatherby home was the one sporting a gleaming white front door with frosted window.
"Would they really come back here, Doctor?" asked Alison, as she snapped the handbrake into place.
"It's the first place we're going to look. It's the first place anyone would look."
"That was a question that I am no longer honour-bound to answer," sniffed Diablerie. "However, your questions have been such a cavalcade of tedium thus far that I will deign to answer for the sake of my own distraction. I doubt the Tainted Ones have other havens, and it may offer us a clue, if nothing else."
Alison followed him to the front door, hugging herself. "They're called Aaron and Jessica." Diablerie paused in the act of rapping his cane upon the door.
"I sense that you disapprove of the Ministry's methods," he said, giving Alison a sidelong look.
"No, no, no, I was just reminding myself." She held his gaze for a moment, then caved under the pressure.
"I totally understand the prison thing, I really do, but I can see how it might look bad to outsiders."
"Then we must rejoice that outsiders need never be concerned with it." He scrutinized the subtle movements of her facial features.
"How would you propose these image problems be addressed, pray, in the eyes of your hypothetical outsider friends?"
"I don't know, they could just..." She looked away. "They could just show them a bit more understanding."
"Understanding," he repeated, rolling the word around his mouth like a distasteful sprout. "I shall consider your counsel. Let it never be said the Diablerie is closed of mind, even to the ideas of the suicidally misinformed."
He bashed the front door with his walking stick so hard that the entire door shuddered in its frame.
"Cower in your pit, children of the taint," he called at full volume. "Diablerie has come to your door. Grant us entry, or be prepared to be smitten with understanding."
The house remained silent and unmoved. Diablerie reached for the handle, and to both his and Alison's surprise, the door fell open, unlocked. Diablerie entered an entrance hall, so small and narrow that he was in the middle of it with a single stride. A set of carpeted steps led upwards, a closed door to the left presumably led to the living room, and an archway at the far end marked a transition from hallway to kitchen. The entire house was plunged into darkness with every curtain closed, lending a certain eeriness to its utter mundanity. Diablerie pulled the living room door open with an elaborate gesture that ended with his hand almost touching the side of his head.
"Hmm," he said, his powerful stare tracking in all directions. "Diablerie confesses himself perplexed by trends in interior decoration."
Alison peered around him and felt nausea flutter down through her torso like confetti. The entire room was coated in what looked in the half-light to be a sticky, dark brown substance, and when the sour, metallic stench hit her nostrils, she knew it to be blood. Everything was covered in it. The flower-patterned sofa with the circular cushions, the scratched coffee table, the electric imitation fireplace with the plastic-moulded coal. She didn't know much about splatter pattern analysis, but there was no way of telling where the stain had begun. It was like an enormous sheet of blood had simply dropped unceremoniously from the ceiling. Unperturbed, Diablerie strode into the middle of the room, the carpet squelching underfoot. "What devilry is afoot in this place?" he wondered aloud. Alison swallowed her horror just far enough to squeeze a few words past it. "Should you be doing that?" Diablerie peered at her. "Hmm?" She fought to assemble coherent words. The crime scene!" He gave her a look that was almost human, then spun on his heel with exaggerated contempt. "Ha! Diablerie cares not for the impotent twiddlings of any mundane investigation. My communion with the spirits will shed the necessary light on this." He thrust out his arms, outstretched palms face down, and seemed to be in a trance for a few moments before he snapped out of it, stepped back over to the door, and flicked the light switch. Just as the ceiling lamp came on, turning the twilit grey-brown of the blood-soaked room a much more vibrant red, a young woman leapt up from behind the sofa. Diablerie jumped a little in surprise, and tried to turn it into a pseudo-mysterious gesture, throwing up his arms and waving them in circular motions. "Please," whimpered the girl. She was blonde and slim, shorter than Alison, wearing a thin white singlet and jogging bottoms that were absolutely soaked through with blood. She kept her elbows pinned rigidly to the sides of her torso, but her forearms were waving back and forth, hands shaking in time with her lower jaw. Diablerie reared back, throwing up his cloak in his usual defensive manoeuvre. "Girl," he hissed in Alison's direction, "is that one of the tainted ones we seek?" "No, it's not Jessica," said Alison, deliberately using the name. Diablerie narrowed his eyes at her for a brief moment, then shook himself and thrust the point of his cane towards the girl. "Very well. You there! We seek two minions of darkness. Reveal them, or be damned!" The girl boggled at him, aghast, then opted to appeal to Alison instead. "Please, they killed them." Alison was about to go to her, but stopped herself moments before she stepped onto the saturated carpet. She compromised by putting out her hands in a somewhat placatory way. "It's okay." She thought back to the many police dramas she had seen on TV. "You're safe now. Nothing to see here. Can you tell us who did this?" The girl's face screwed up even further.
"They were two. They looked human, but they were monsters."
Diablerie's cane decisively slammed into the carpet with a wet thunk. "We have confirmed the presence of tainted ones," he announced, stepping back into the hall and dropping to one knee. "I can now channel the spirits and divine the route by which they left this place. It will take some time, girl. Search the upstairs rooms." "Right." She made the placatory gesture again for the survivor's benefit. "Just stay here, all right? We'll get you out of here really soon." The girl just stared, standing awkwardly in the middle of the bloody room. Diablerie held his cane vertically in front of him, facing the front door, bowed his head, and began emitting many of the same silly noises he had demonstrated on the car ride from the station. Alison hurried up most of the steps and slowed as she reached the top. The upper floor was also shrouded in darkness, with all the bedroom doors closed and the one open door leading into a dull bathroom with peach fittings. But what made Alison stop was a subtle sound on the edge of hearing, just audible over Diablerie's gibbering, a strange arrhythmic fluttering. She rounded the banister and determined that the sound was coming from the door at the far end of the landing, probably one of the bedrooms. She crept closer, and as her eyes adjusted, she saw irregular flashes of white light at the gap beneath the door. The sound became more like a harsh, insectile chittering. Her first instinct was to go back and tell Diablerie, but she didn't want to interrupt whatever he thought he was doing in the hall. It was getting hard to think. Adrenaline had turned her ordered mind into a six-lane pile-up. She knew she wasn't ready for this, but at the same time she could picture Elizabeth Lawrence sarcastically asking her why she had chosen to dawdle outside the door as the nightmare had been free to unfurl. She made up her mind to open the door, but first, there being no sense in going unprepared, she grabbed a toilet plunger from the bathroom, which she held in front of her for want of a single line of defence. Then she outstretched one finger toward the bedroom door, leaned the rest of her as far back as she could, braced herself, and gently pushed it open. "Shut the door!" yelled Jessica Weatherby, before glancing up and slipping her headphones off. "Who are you?" She looked exactly as she had in the school photograph, Same unflattering glasses, same black hair, same dumpy build. She was wearing a T-shirt with some baffling in-joke emblazoned on it, and sitting in a computer chair with a towel draped over the backrest. The source of the sound had been her fingers racing across a computer keyboard, and the source of the lights had been a pair of monitors, one of which was displaying a children's superhero cartoon. Jessica's eyes bulged as they took in Allison's attack stance, and her outstretched fingers stiffened.
"Are you here to take us back?"
she said in a quivering voice. "Well," Jessica swiveled in her chair to face Allison properly.
"I'm really, really sorry. I know it was bad of us to run, but, look, I wasn't really liking it there."
She clasped her hands.
"Mum and Dad aren't here right now, but they totally don't want us to go back either. Honest, we called them, and they said to tell you."
"I won't take you back," assured Allison. "I won't do anything you don't want me to. I'm not one of them." Her eyes darted between Jessica and an Interstellar Bum Pirates poster on the bedroom wall for a few moments, until inspiration struck. "Actually, I escaped from the school as well."
"You did?"
Jessica cocked her head, bewildered.
"How did you know to come here?"
A second round of inspiration struck. "I'm a friend of Aaron's. He said I could hide out here too." Jessica's gaze drifted down to Allison's hand.
"Did he tell you to clean the toilet?"
What Allison had taken for a plunger in the darkness was, in fact, a toilet brush. She examined its bristles distastefully. Something occurred on Jessica's computer monitor, and it immediately captured all of her attention. She half-turned back and started typing with one hand.
"Sorry, I was in the middle of messaging someone. So you've got a magic power as well?"
"Yes." That didn't feel like enough. "I've got an eidetic memory." Jessica frowned.
"That's a magic power?"
"Yes, definitely."
"Oh, well, it's better than mine. I just sweat a lot."
Allison blinked.
"What? That's my power? I sweat a lot? Like, a lot?"
She indicated the towel on her backrest.
"Like, enough that it becomes weird? I can turn it on and off now, though."
"Jessica," said Allison, as the girl's gaze returned permanently to the objects on the screen and she resumed typing, all danger of recapture forgotten. "Can you tell me where Aaron is now? It's important." Jessica's eyes and mouth were smiling as she saw something she liked on the computer screen, but her voice, directed at Allison, was in a monotone.
"He's downstairs."
Allison thought of the blood-stained room and swallowed.
I didn't see him there." "No, that's his power," said Jessica, finally looking at her again. "He does things to other people's minds, so they see things that aren't really there. He said he was going to set up a trap or something. I didn't really pay attention."
Allison was already pulling the bedroom door closed, her stomach gripped with foreboding. She raced back to the top of the stairs, preparing to yell a warning. From here she could see Diablery, still crouched towards the door, his vocalizations currently going through the blom, blom, blom stage, and she could see part of the floor of the bloody living room. It was still red, but the redness was wavering and indistinct. It seemed to extrude from the background, like an afterimage. The mysterious girl came back into view directly below Allison, approaching Diablery from the kitchen. But the illusion of her appearance was starting to waver, too. Allison found that if she focused her gaze on Diablery and looked at the girl through the corner of her vision, then her image flickered back and forth between the blonde girl and a much taller, more masculine figure, with a mass of shaggy black hair. Aaron Weatherby was either getting tired or having trouble keeping Allison's mind clouded now that he didn't know where she was. His form warped and shimmered more and more as he stalked towards the unwitting Diablery, raising a hand as if to slap him on the back. For one all-important moment, Allison saw something in his hand as his image shifted to his true form, something shiny and shaped like a kitchen knife. Adrenaline took over. Allison vaulted over the banister and dropped onto the shifting figure, which would have been a much more dramatic gesture if they had been in a larger house. She only had to drop 2 or 3 feet, but it was enough to knock Weatherby over and pull him to the floor with her. For a few moments, Allison's world was a disorganized mess of scuffling sounds and extreme close-ups of clothing and body parts, before she found herself pinning precisely nothing to the floor. She hesitated and glanced away, prompting the nothing to make its counter-attack. The carpet below her surged upwards, flipping her onto her back. two skinny hands clamped around her throat.
Not going back!
Hissed Aaron Weatherby. His nasally teenage voice seemed to be overlaid with something deeper, more booming, and considerably less human.
Not going back!
Allison struggled to breathe as the stranglehold tightened. As the possibility of death loomed large, time seemed to slow down. All she could see was Aaron's face, now that he had dropped out of his illusions, filling her clouding vision from edge to edge. Unlike Jessica, he had undergone some changes since his school photo had been taken. A clump of hair on his left temple had fallen out, revealing a swollen cluster of round lumps that transitioned from raw red at the base to sickly green in the centre. His left eye, closest to the mutation, had turned a uniform cloudy yellow. Allison's head felt like it had been inflated with hot air, and all she could do was stare at Aaron's hideous boils and wonder if they were painful. Then, like a trickle of gasoline towards the spark, that thought led her to grope with her hand and tighten around the toilet brush she still had with her. She drove the brush into the side of Aaron's head with full force. The bristles dug into his sensitive scarring with 100 sharp points of contact. He emitted an animalistic roar and fell to the side, releasing his grip and letting the oxygen flood luxuriously back into Allison's brain. Immediately she was on him, pinning down all four of his limbs with her entire mass. He tried to disappear again, but Allison clamped her hands tightly around his skinny arms and concentrated on that, not the evidence of her other senses. His body flickered like a broken TV picture and flashed through different forms as rapidly as he could think of them. The blonde girl, Diablerie, Allison herself, the Prime Minister, a giant mutant shark with human arms and legs that Allison was pretty sure had been a villain in an episode of Interstellar Bum Pirates, then finally back to Aaron's true form, as he stopped struggling and went limp, exhausted. Panting, Allison looked to Diablerie. He was in the same spot as before, but was now standing upright with his eyes closed, pointing two fingers at Allison. "I need help!" she gasped. He opened his eyes and scowled. "I am providing it! I have been using all my energy to transmit positive vibrations to aid your victory. A little gratitude would not go amiss." Allison stared at him, then took a big, calming breath. "Could you help me pin him down?" Diablerie cocked an eyebrow. "Wouldn't you like to show it some understanding first?" "Please," begged Allison, frustrated tears beading in her eyes. "Oh, very well," he said grudgingly, coming over. Allison tentatively relaxed her limbs, but then hopped back in surprise as Diablerie smartly slammed his foot down upon Aaron's throat with considerable force. The teenager made distressed choking noises for a few seconds. Then Diablerie relaxed the pressure slightly and followed up with a ringing thwack to the side of his head with his walking cane. Allison hopped again, startled.
"Doctor? Hmm? You don't have to hit him like that."
He looked down, then back to her, unconcerned.
"Oh, I do apologize," he said, witheringly sarcastic. "Perhaps Diablerie should repair to the kitchen to prepare drinks and finger food for the beast, while he resumes throttling you. Your ignorance grows tiresome, girl. Diablerie's shoe shall meet the throat of every tainted one that pollutes our realm, if it will block the slithering protrusions of their hideous masters. Now didst thou find evidence of the other's whereabouts?"
Allison glanced between Aaron's wriggling form and Diablerie's unperturbed face. She imagined Jessica Weatherby struggling to breathe under the point of a walking stick, getting dragged back to the exercise yard as she desperately sweated excessively. "No," she eventually said. "No one's up there. I think he must have sent her off and stayed here to slow us down." Diablerie's eyes narrowed piercingly.
"And how thorough a search did you conduct, girl?"
He didn't know. He couldn't possibly know. It was a small house, but he'd been chanting too loudly to hear anything from upstairs. "Surely." Allison squared her shoulders and swallowed. Lying to him was requiring her to fight all her usual instincts. "I looked everywhere. Jessica isn't here." An age seemed to pass. Then Diablerie dropped his gaze.
"Indeed, the spirits had relayed as much. Come, then. We shall return this one to the school and check in with those fools at the ministry."
He fluttered his cloak. "Diablerie has foreseen it." "Could you wait one moment, please?" said Alison, making calmly for the stairs. "I just need to, put this toilet brush back." Diablerie had already slung the unconscious Aaron over his shoulder, in a display of surprising strength given his slender build. "As you wish. We shall regroup at the car. Do not keep me waiting. Diablerie and this creature lack the common ground for stimulating conversation." Alison ran back upstairs, chucked the toilet brush in the vague direction of the open bathroom, and pulled Jessica's bedroom door open with such suddenness that she managed to tear Jessica's gaze away from her computer screen for all of 1 second. "Listen," said Alison, hushed and breathless. "You have to get out of here. They've taken Aaron." Jessica blinked and pursed her lips, nonplussed. "Who have?" The school. The people from the school. They've taken him, and they'll take you too if you stay here." Fear filled Jessica's eyes, like milk into a bowl of cereal. "But where do I go?" "Anywhere." Alison dug her government credit card out of her pocket and slapped it onto the desktop. "You can have this. Get a train ticket, stay with relatives, rent a room somewhere. I don't know." She looked at her monitor the way a puppy looks to their new owner as they leave for work for the first time. "Can I buy a new computer?" "Yes, whatever you like. Just don't be here if you don't want to get taken back to the school." From the front of the house, Diablerie impatiently sounded the car horn, which played the first few notes of Bach's Toccata and Fugue in D minor. "I'm sorry, this is all the help I can give. I have to go." "All right," said Jessica to Allison's retreating back. "I'll go as soon as this show's downloaded." 13. Jess. "Back. Going AFK for a while now, though." XX Reaver XX. "Oh, am I going to have to say I told you so?" "No, just have to go hide somewhere else." "So by no, what you meant was yes. Where will you go now?" "Dunno. Probably towards London. I stayed in a travelodge with Mum and Dad once. I'll probably do that." "I thought you didn't have any money. I thought you said that was why you had to hide in your own house, after I pointed out what a stupid idea that was." "Got a credit card."
"Since when?"
"Just now."
"You just now got a credit card? You know what, I'm thinking back to all the things you told me about going to a special school and having magic powers, and it's just occurred to me that I probably shouldn't have believed it all so quickly."
"I'm not a liar."
"So you just magicked up a credit card, did you?"
"No, someone gave me it."
"Right." Jess has sent an image. Newcard.png.
"There, I sent a picture of it."
"Oh, come on, I can hardly see that. Can't even make out the numbers." Jess has sent an image. Newcard2.png.
"You can read the numbers in this one?"
"Could have gotten that off image search. I believe you if you could show me the back of the card as well." Jess has sent an image. Newcard3.png.
"Huh. Well, that security code certainly looks real."
"Yeah, ye of little faith.
How could I have ever underestimated you?
Wait, I still disbelieve you a tiny bit. What was the expiry date again?"
14. Elizabeth Lawrence was usually the first member of the ministry's off-site staff to arrive each morning. Even the monks who lived on-site were mostly asleep when she came in. She found it useful to have an hour or two of meditative silence and solitude before having to take the weight of the day's responsibilities. So she was slightly chagrined when she arrived at the Hand of Merlin's antechamber and found Alison Arkin already there, sitting on the guest's chair in front of the desk and clinging to the seat, as if she was afraid it could rocket into the sky at any moment. Elizabeth paused at the sight of her, then slowly made her way across the wide floor, walking stick clacking with a businesslike rhythm, before settling smoothly into her chair. Even then she didn't look directly at Alison, but stared at her blank monitor, resting her chin on one hand. She only spoke after she had counted to 30.
"Good morning, Miss Arkin. What can I do for you?"
"Miss Lawrence, I'm really sorry," said Alison, barely putting the spaces between the words. "I don't want you to think that I'm the kind of person who just gives up on things.
In brief, you do not wish to be Diablerie's assistant," said Elizabeth.
"I'm really sorry," repeated Alison, not quite getting as far as yes. "The thing is..."
"Very well, you can be mine instead." Come back at the official start of the work day, and I'll have some errands for you to run. She finally looked Allison in the eye. Was there anything else?
Said Allison, stumbling as she mentally dismantled the lengthy explanation on which she had spent most of the night working.
Elizabeth sighed. Very well. Why don't you want to be Diablerie's assistant?
I think he might be insane.
Yes, you're not alone in that.
Elizabeth turned on her monitor, and it immediately displayed a document she had loaded up the previous evening.
Possibly mad, she read aloud. Constantly claims to possess arcane powers and knowledge that are absolutely not in evidence. Demonstrated incompetence that very nearly resulted in our deaths. This was the report that Diablerie's last assistant submitted after his first day, along with a transfer request. Frankly, I'm surprised it took you as long as it did.
I seriously almost died, said Allison, dropping the bomb. He stood there watching Aaron Weatherby strangling me, after I saved him from getting stabbed.
Elizabeth's eyes widened a little, showed the merest ounce of sympathy, then returned to normal. There's something you should know about Dr. Diablerie. He has spent a longer time as a S.W.O.R.D. agent than anyone else in the entire history of the Ministry. No one else has ever stayed in the job that long. It's a dangerous position that most agents see as a brief, unpleasant stepping stone to a safer role in intelligence or administration.
I can see why, said Allison, her voice quavering slightly.
Not only has Diablerie survived more assignments than anyone else, he has a 100% success rate. He himself has never been injured in the field. He has had a number of assistants, none of whom have been seriously hurt, but have requested transfers after traumatic incidents that left them with superficial bumps and bruises.
Unconsciously, Allison touched the red marks on her throat. They were already fading.
Right.
Elizabeth dug a thick stack of file folders out of her lowest drawer and dropped them onto the desk as if she was shaking something nasty off her palm.
Every single one of those assistants, every single one of Diablerie's own reports, paint a picture of a dangerous, possibly delusional incompetent, whose victories come only as a result of sheer dumb luck.
Allison didn't reply, but ran her finger down the stack of files. There were an awful lot of them.
I no longer believe in dumb luck,
said Elizabeth, leaning forward and clasping her hands.
Not after this much miraculous success. There is no doubt in my mind that Diablerie is hiding something.
Are you sure? In response, Elizabeth produced an exercise book from the same drawer the reports had come from. Silently, she pushed it across the desk. Allison opened it to the first page and saw that it was filled with tiny block capitals scrawled with a shaking hand, lifting and curving from the line and going into weird spiral patterns that covered all the available space. She caught the phrase, "The rats in my mind, they crawl up the walls!" and that summarized the overall tone of the work.
One of the assistants I gave to Diablerie was a telepath, under orders to secretly read his mind and determine his intentions. She nodded to the book. That is the report he submitted.
Fascinated, Allison fluttered through to the back cover. Every single page was covered in the writing.
He wrote all this?
No, that's book one.
Elizabeth sighed.
I gather that book 30 will be completed as soon as he sneaks another crayon past the orderlies. Diablerie seems to have a very effective psychic defense mechanism. That is what leads me to believe that he is hiding something, along with his constant attempts to frighten off the assistance I provide.
Allison let the weathered cover of the exercise book flop back down.
So it's all an act?
She hurriedly continued as Elizabeth's eyebrow rose. Okay, obviously it's an act, but I could understand wanting the enemy to think you're stupid or insane, but why the people you work for as well?
Elizabeth leaned back, folding her arms. Why, indeed. We may not be the only people he works for. We don't know of any specific groups working against us. But that's no reason to assume that none exist. Some organized magical terrorist organization, perhaps, with objections to some of the Ministry's methods.
Like the secondary school? Said Allison, not privately enough. She flinched a little as Elizabeth's piercing gaze zeroed in on her like a drone targeting system.
Allison, she said, in a soft voice that didn't match her look, I can't force you to stay with Diablerie, but you and that special gift of yours may be my last hope
of determining his true agenda. I know that we can do this, Allison. Together.
Allison had been reliving the events of the previous day, trying to analyze Diablerie's actions. The sound of his foot plunging into Aaron Weatherby's neck was still vivid and almost tangible. But all her thoughts disappeared under Elizabeth's words like cockroaches scattering from a spotlight. For the first time, she noticed that the older woman was not as old as she had first appeared. The lines of her face had deepened prematurely, but she couldn't have been older than 40.
"You really think so?" said Allison, eyes glimmering.
Elizabeth closed her eyes and nodded deeply.
"I do."
"And you don't think I was really in danger? He was just trying to scare me?" Elizabeth placed an old-fashioned mobile before her, one that still had numbered buttons.
"Take this. If he tries to take it beyond scaring, and you ever feel you're genuinely in danger, you can use it to contact me directly. I can have you extracted within 20 minutes.
"Right," said Allison, re-energized, as she worried the phone into her hip pocket.
"Use it to report in as well, every evening, every detail of Diablerie's movements, to me alone."
Allison nodded rapidly. "I can do that, I can do that."
"I'll let you know when we have a new assignment for Diablerie."
"Okay."
"What did you think of the secondary school?"
asked Elizabeth, throwing the question out like a spear to the leg as the younger woman turned to leave. Allison slowly turned back, tightening her grip on the seat of her chair.
"Well, it must have come as a surprise, after having only seen the primary school,"
prompted Elizabeth, keeping her tone entirely emotionless.
"Yes, yes, it was a surprise. It seemed efficient."
Elizabeth stared, dialed up the intensity a few notches. Allison was starting to feel like an ant under a magnifying glass on a hot summer's day.
"You didn't think it was oppressive?"
"Maybe a bit," said Allison, so quietly that she wasn't doing much more than shaping the consonants with her mouth. Elizabeth softened. It was like watching the victim of a gorgon transmute back to flesh from stone.
"I agree."
"You do?"
100 years ago, the ministry's policy was to round up and slaughter everyone who carried the taint," said Elizabeth, eyes glazing over sadly. "The schools were only introduced around the 1920s. When I first became Master Apprentice, employing tainted ones as senior sword agents was unheard of. Since then I have successfully integrated them, and reduced the average length of their stay in the secondary school from 14 months to 8.
"But why do they have to go there at all?"
Elizabeth's glare came out again, and Allison shrank. "The taint must be suppressed. It's a manifestation of the ancient's will. It cannot be allowed to destroy our way of life."
"Right."
"The point is, the ministry is set in its ways. There is plenty of room for modernization, and I have spent the last decade moving things in that direction. But it cannot be done at the expense of stability. Change can only come slowly, carefully. Otherwise, everything could collapse around our ears. Do you understand?"
Allison opened her mouth to say what she assumed Elizabeth wanted to hear, but was silenced by the crash of a door slamming against stone. Both women looked over in time to see Richard Danvers hurl himself into the antechamber at a full sprint, with sweat patches under his armpits resembling outline maps of war-torn African nations. He skittered to a halt at Elizabeth's desk, then thrust his brand-new tablet forward, like Perseus presenting his mirrored shield. "You need to see this," he gasped, before inhaling a huge lungful of air. "Right now!"
"If you're just joining us, here is the breaking news," said a newsreader's voice coming from the tablet's tinny speaker. "A procession of what can only be described as creatures made from living slime is making its way down Marsham Street in London."
Elizabeth stared.
"Ah."
15. "We can go live now to our helicopter over Marsham Street. Peter, can you tell us anything about what we're seeing here?"
"I certainly can, Pippa. You can see the slime creatures arranged into a sort of rank and marching south along Marsham Street, if marching is a word that can apply here.
Can you tell us where the creatures came from, Peter?"
"Yes, Pippa, there are witness reports stating that they emerged from the Thames near the Palace of Westminster just after daybreak,
but we are also hearing reports that they may have been spotted throughout the country on a number of occasions during the last couple of weeks. The police have shut down the roads to motorists and, are generally doing a wonderful job of keeping order. Peter, is this some kind of alien invasion? I think the general consensus at this point is that this is not an invasion, Pippa. And what is that based on, Peter? Well, Pippa, I think partly this consensus is based on the fact that the creatures have gone out of their way to avoid creating violence or confrontation during this, demonstration, but largely I believe it comes from the man walking at the head of the procession because he's wearing a sandwich board bearing the words, "This is not an invasion," in block capitals. Yes, I think we can see the man now. He definitely seems to be leading the slime creatures. Could he be their owner or their controller, Peter? I think the consensus is that he isn't, Pippa. That's what the next part of the sandwich board deals with. It says that he is not the leader or a prisoner of the creatures. He is helping them of his own free will to get to the Home Office and request refugee status. Do we have any clue as to the identity of the man, Peter? Yes, Pippa, we do. Yes, sources have identified him as one Henry Woolston, the main source being the signature at the bottom of his sandwich board. You know what, perhaps we could zoom the camera in so you can read it for yourself, Pippa. Yes, you can see him very clearly there now. We are currently attempting to narrow down which of the many Henry Woolstons in Britain he is, but we don't have anything concrete just yet. As you can see, he does have a very generic face. Peter, can we believe everything the sandwich board says at this stage? I'll be honest with you, Pippa, it's certainly possible that we can't, but if we can't, then that does rather throw a spanner in the works vis-a-vis our understanding of the situation out here.
The clip ended, and Pippa Mormont swiveled on her stool to address the camera, putting on her television face, questioning and curious, but with all the nation's healthy scepticism embodied in her slightly raised eyebrow. "That was a clip from our coverage of the fluidic demonstration this morning," she said. "Joining us now in the studio are Henry Woolston, Home Secretary Serena Smith, and representative of the fluidic people, Shigs Fuchs." There was a brief chorus of hellos, one male, one female, one sounding like it was bubbling through frog spawn. "If I could turn to you first, Shukshuthuks," she addressed the mound of grey slime sitting in the plastic paddling pool that was the only thing the runner had been able to find at short notice. "What is it that you and your people want exactly here in our world?"
"We wish to become productive members of society,"
gurgled Shukshuthuks, as Henry unconsciously mouthed along with the words he had suggested.
"We can eat all our rubbish and do not require homes, so we can reduce our carbon footprint and have no impact on the ongoing housing crisis. We excrete only a mixture of gases that have no long-term negative effect on the environment."
"Can I just ask, Shukshuthuks, how you learned to speak English?" said Pippa, recrossing her legs interestedly.
"We surf our internet."
"The fluidics have the ability to make limited changes to their chemical composition at will," interjected Henry. The BBC had provided him with a modern suit to replace his weathered travelling gear, but he hadn't been able to tidy up his hair, so he looked like a trendy fashion journalist. Apparently they found a way to turn themselves into sort of organic Wi-Fi adapters and were able to do a lot of research before they, revealed themselves to me.
"Yes,"
confirmed Shugshuthuks, forming a smiley face.
"We love YouTube."
"Henry, you have been acting as a liaison and advisor for the fluidics," said Pippa, smartly switching rails with barely a jump. "I understand the demonstration this morning was largely designed and organized by you."
"Yes," said Henry, shifting in his seat. "Obviously, the last thing we wanted to be was disruptive, but my thinking was Shugshuthuks and his people are so unique, and so alien to our conventional understanding of sentient life, that people just wouldn't have believed it if we didn't go as public as possible. I thought it would mean they couldn't be swept under the rug by the government." "Serena Smith, any response to that?" prompted Pippa, rotating smoothly to address the third guest.
"Well, I think that's a rather paranoid line of thinking. I'm sure conventional channels would have been perfectly adequate," said the Home Secretary. "We are presently assessing what obligations, if any, the British government has towards its citizens that originate from alternative dimensions."
"Sorry, if I could just pick you up on that first point there," said Henry, holding up a finger like a schoolboy who isn't 100% certain he has the correct answer.
The whole reason Shugshuthuks and his people did so much research before appearing was that they have attempted to enter our world in the past, and were apparently always very swiftly killed by human beings. Well, what's more, on the way down to London, I encountered a man who seemed to be fully aware of the Fluidic's existence and announced his intention to slaughter them. He let the shocked silence percolate for a second before giving it the chaser. He told me that he worked for the government.
I can assure you I have absolutely no knowledge of this, said Smith automatically. If there is some rogue branch of the civil service committing such monstrous acts, it will be addressed with absolute top priority.
Can you tell us any more about this man and who he worked for, Mr. Woolston? Asked Pippa. He said he was part of something called the Ministry of Occultism? In the cafeteria of the secret catacombs beneath Westminster Abbey, where a dense throng of monks and office workers were clustered around the communal television, Victor Kaysen leaned back.
Well, he said, it was nice while it lasted.
16. There was a strange atmosphere in the ministry headquarters the next morning. Everyone was staying in their office and pretending to work, so the halls were as quiet as the tomb they had so much else in common with. Alison was reminded of the day she left the primary school, except people were avoiding eye contact with everyone else, not just her. Diablerie wasn't called into action every single day, and no one seemed to know where he went in between assignments, so Alison had ended up assisting Elizabeth anyway. There hadn't been any official declaration of this. Elizabeth had simply instructed her to go to Richard Danvers' office to pick up the Hand of Merlin's agenda, and that had decided the matter. Alison hesitated as the open door to the swordkeeper's office, the first door after the sword archway, came into view. There was no need to be nervous, she told herself. Danvers was a professional. All she had to do was be professional straight back. She stopped beside the door to draw in and release a deep breath, then stepped into the doorway, knocking on the frame. This proved unnecessary, as Danvers had not been working, but sitting at his desk staring into space. He said nothing, but he didn't need to. His gaze was heavy with meaning as it slowly focused on her. What cruel purpose inflicts you on my little island of peace?
Miss Lawrence needs the agenda for the Hand of Merlin meeting today, said Alison, hand still curled in the act of knocking.
Danvers held the slightly affronted look for a second, then his gaze dropped as his hand came up and pushed a single piece of paper across the desk. Here, if she thinks it's worth it. Only one issue anyone's talking about today.
Okay, said Alison, reaching for the page.
Do me a favour, just for safety's sake. Try not to look at it. Alison gave a little good-natured laugh, which abruptly stopped when Richard didn't join in.
Mr. Danvers, she said. I feel like what happened might have given you a bad impression of me. Can I just say how truly sorry I am, and—
Richard pinched his eyes and waved a dismissive hand.
Alison, listen, I know it must have been a huge thing to you, but I honestly have far too much to think about to stay angry about it. Just do two good jobs for everyone you foul up. That's all anyone can—
His brow furrowed.
Do you hear that?
Alison strained her ears. There was a gentle tapping sound coming from nearby, which, upon analysis, could also have been an extremely violent banging muffled by distance. Wordlessly, Danvers was on his feet and out the door, following the sound. Alison wondered if following closely behind like a puppy would enforce her reputation for mindless instruction following, and ultimately decided to compromise by trailing a conservative 4 or 5 feet. The banging was coming from the top of the entrance stairway, and in the time it took for Danvers and Alison to reach the main hall, the noise only grew louder and more violent. A number of monks and other ministry staff members had already drifted over to investigate, including Adam and Victor.
"What is that?" asked Danvers, squinting up the steps.
"Someone's banging on the secret door," observed Victor, hands in pockets.
"Do you think we should let them in?" asked Adam.
Victor snorted. "It'd kind of undermine the point of a secret door, wouldn't it?"
"Look, we knew something like this was going to happen," said Adam.
"Yeah, we know the planet's going to explode eventually. Doesn't mean we should all set ourselves on fire now."
The banging abruptly stopped, but that only raised the tension. It was a stop that signalled a change of tactics rather than an end to the incident. Sure enough, a minute's wary silence was broken by the clacking of Elizabeth Lawrence's walking stick, and the congregation parted like the Red Sea as she entered the scene.
"Let him in," she said, grimly.
She was clutching her smartphone. The monk with the best reflexes obediently broke from the crowd to dash up the stairway, hitching up the bottom of his robe. The others watched as he ascended past the slight curve that took him out of sight, and the banging began again with renewed impatience. Eventually the banging ceased, and moments later the monk reappeared, stiffly descending the stairway with head bowed like an admonished husband. He was swiftly overtaken by another man, briskly descending the stairs two at a time. He was dressed in the same outfit as Richard Danvers, rumpled shirt sleeves and tie, but was filling it to bursting with the physique of an urban gym dweller. His neck was thicker than his face, with fat red veins extruding over his collar, and his hair was a light dusting of flame-orange bristles. He stomped into the middle of the throng with such confidence that those nearest unconsciously took a step back.
"All right, boys,"
he said, in a raucous South London accent, clasping his hands with glee. He looked one of the monks up and down.
"And girls. So this is the Ministry of Cultists, is it? Wow, I love what you've done with this place."
"Occultism," said Elizabeth, stepping forward. "Are you from Downing Street?" The newcomer bowed low and gave a simpering smile.
"Oh, I'm so sorry. Where are my manners? Sean Anderson, policy advisor to the Cabinet."
He offered a hand that nobody took.
"I've heard all about this place. You in charge, are you?"
"I'm the Master Apprentice. The Hand of Merlin are in charge."
"That's right. You know, I've heard that the Friends of Gandalf will be meeting in the next few minutes. I'd love it if I could sit in and see them in action. That'd just be a dream come true."
Elizabeth shifted her weight. "The meetings of the Hand of Merlin have been held in absolute secrecy since records began." Anderson leaned in, his face darkening. The veins on his neck turned the colour of a freshly cooked lobster.
"I'm here on direct orders from the Prime Minister, which I'm pretty sure outranks whatever authority you think you've got. So why don't you get me a coffee before I call on the massive quantities of shit I've got all loaded up and ready to bring down on your little clubhouse?"
Elizabeth held his gaze. "Alison, make coffee." Alison decided, of her own free will, to make coffee. 17.
"The Hand will speak," announced the spokesman of the Hand of Merlin. "We will continue to observe the activities of the Shoggoths within the public eye, and the Master Apprentice will act, according to her discretion, as developments occur. The Hand has spoken, the Master Apprentice is dismissed."
"I return now to the world of men, refreshed from the fount of your inestimable wisdom," recited Elizabeth. A gong sounded, and the meeting was over. She had expected the worst from Anderson, but he had taken up position just inside the door as soon as they had entered, and despite a few unrestrained sniggering sounds throughout the initial exchange of phrases, he had been mysteriously silent. When she turned around to leave the meeting hall, she discovered why. He wasn't there. He had snuck out and left the grand entrance doors ajar. She found him in the antechamber, sitting on her chair with the seat tilted back and his thick ankles crossed on top of her desk. He gave her a smile that was isolated to his mouth, the rest of his face wanting nothing to do with it, and loudly slow-clapped as she approached.
"Bravo," he said. "Lovely bit of amateur dramatics. Sit."
Elizabeth opted to remain standing, leaning on her cane. "What do you want?"
"I want to have a chat about the future of your little operation."
"The Hand of Merlin are the masters."
"Yeah, my gran keeps telling me that her cat's own her, and she's off her head as well. Let's say goodbye to the bullshit van. Goodbye, bullshit van."
He waved theatrically to a spot in the middle distance.
"There, it's gone. Now I won't bullshit you, and you don't get to bullshit me. So don't give me any more of that about you not having your hand right up those rattled on finger puppets in there."
Elizabeth eyed the grand entrance to the Hand of Merlin's chamber to be doubly certain she had closed it properly. "What kind of trouble is the Ministry in?"
"Don't know if you noticed down here in the make-believe bunker, but there are sentient puddles from another dimension up top appearing on chat shows and generally being lovable and popular. And they keep talking about this Ministry of Occultism thing that was a-trying to murder them all. A lot of people are asking the government some very angry questions."
"It was a misunderstanding," said Elizabeth through tightened lips. "We assumed they were hostile until now because we had no means to communicate with the Shoggoths."
"You do not use that word, you psycho,"
shouted Anderson, aghast.
"That is the new N-word. Overseas Development used it in an interview this morning. I had to kiss every bollock on Fleet Street to get it spiked."
Elizabeth tottered a little. "They only appeared yesterday. How can there already be—"
"Yeah, welcome to the age of instant communication, love.
They've already got slurs, an equal rights movement. I hear they've got a sketch show starting on Channel 4 in the new year. But the fluidics aren't your biggest problem. They were just what shone the light on you. People have found out about the tampons.
Elizabeth reddened slightly.
I see. Yeah, was that your idea? Pretty smart, hiding your funding in the budget under women's sanitary products. Nobody ever questions that one. But now some twat online sounds madding up and the press are demanding to know what we did with all the tampons.
Give me some time, said Elizabeth, speaking slowly and firmly to penetrate Anderson's confident stream of words. I can reform the ministry's practices.
There's no time, steamrolled Anderson. We are, as of yesterday, living in a world where magic is a thing. That means we need a government department for it. But the one we have is carrying too much baggage. We're going to have to rebuild it. And before we do that, we have to take it apart. Preferably with dynamite. We're going to do a Wicker Man. A sacrifice.
What's going to happen?
At the end of the week, the ministry will be exposed by a leak containing the names of everyone in the Gandalf Club, or whatever you called it.
The identities of the Hand of Merlin are a closely guarded...
Not a problem, because you're going to tell me them.
Elizabeth blinked a few times, then finally took a seat in front of Anderson. You need to explain how you imagined this taking place. He rolled his eyes.
Look, you've been very savvy here. I'm almost impressed. You've got us in a bind. The ministry's got to go, but we still need a department of magic or whatever, and you and your lot seem to be the only lunatics who know anything about this stuff. The way I see it, we've got a ready-made scapegoat with your teddy bear collection in there, thinking they're in charge. We scrape all the bad stuff off on them and chuck them out the window for the wolves. Meanwhile, nice new smiley open non-secretive government department opens, and we very, very quietly bring in you and all the other crazy bastards, preferably in an unmarked van.
Elizabeth tightened her mouth even further. Her eyes flicked to the Hand of Merlin's doorway just for an instant, but not quickly enough to go unnoticed. Anderson sighed, kicked his legs off the desk, and scooted the chair forwards.
Listen, love, there's no negotiation here. It's out of my hands. Wheels are in motion. You got two choices. You can either be a ruthless psycho who's still got a job, or you can be a loyal psycho, standing proudly with the suckers, while the nation pulls your panties down and has a good old rummage.
She met his gaze. I want to pick the ones that come with me. The cheerful grin expanded across his face like a bloodstain spreading from a bullet-riddled corpse. He waggled a finger.
Oh, I like you, Lawrence. Everyone is mad, but you're evil as well. Evil I can work with.
He slapped both hands onto the desktop loudly and pushed himself back onto his feet.
Get a list together by the end of the day. I'll see myself out.
Elizabeth remained precisely where she was, legs crossed demurely. When Anderson stopped and spun around, halfway to the door, she slightly turned her head.
Oh, almost forgot, he said. Are there wizards?
She hesitated.
You've been getting a lot of reports from the public, now the fluidics are out, about magic shit. Lots of insane bollocks, obviously, but I just want to check this one thing. Are there wizards? Witches? You know, people with magic powers.
Yes, there are people with magical infusions, said Elizabeth, after only a moment's pause. Anderson tensed up. The only movement in his body was the accelerated throbbing of the veins on his neck.
Please tell me you nutters don't kill them as well.
Of course not, said Elizabeth, affronted. We would never kill human beings. We provide guidance, education, and protection to the magically infused. Sean Anderson gave a long, relieved sigh and let his shoulders drop.
Cool. No offence. Didn't want to assume anything. As long as there ain't any nasty surprises waiting for us there.
18. From Sean Anderson. 2. Office of the Prime Minister. Ministry of Celtism?
Les. Went over Lawrence's list. Thankfully she didn't want to bring over any of the weirdos in the robes. Maybe there's hope for her yet. Managed to get some alone time with most of the key psychos. Wrote up some notes for you. The rest are mainly office monkeys, probably not worth fretting about. Richard Danvers, Swordkeeper, Reed, Fieldwork Administrator. Bit of a hiccup in that he's the son of one of the Gandalfs, but we probably can't say no since he's got the contacts for all the field agents. We'll probably see if we can properly organise that lot into an official magic police force or whatever. Something to think about further down the line. Plus he's about as normal as this freak show gets. Archibald Brooks Stodgley, Scrollkeeper, Reed, Archivist. Old boy, chummy with most of the Gandalfs. Some very toxic views on our new magical friends. Lawrence says we need him because he's instrumental to the intelligence wing. But I think that's only because no one else understands his filing system.
Recommend keep until we can get all the records digitized, then drop like hot potato. Alison Arkin, Lawrence's assistant. Personality like a sheet of cardboard, but Lawrence was weirdly insistent about her, and I'm not bothered. Young pretty face might be useful for image purposes if she keeps her trap shut. Victor Kaysen, Adam Heskett, Swords, Reed, senior field agents. Bit of a surprise. Here was me about to suggest getting some token magic bods in the new department, only to find there's already a couple. They act like they're about to start accusing each other of laying down the eggy fart in English class, but they're good ink however you look at it. Dr. Diablery, senior field agent. Very impressive success record, speaks for itself. Might be worth grooming as public face of efficient paranormal services. Didn't have a chance to meet today, but might catch them tomorrow. Sean. P.S. Are we still allowed to say paranormal? Haven't checked Facebook today.
From Sean Anderson to Office of the Prime Minister. Ministry of Cultism.
Met Diablery. Scratch plans. Do not let him get in front of any cameras, for the love of God.
Three months later. 19.
Keep out, said Adam Hesketh, reading aloud the signs as he and Victor walked straight past them. Extreme danger. Surviving trespassers will be prosecuted. I think this is the place.
Victor, playing with his phone, grunted an acknowledgement. After ignoring three layers of security fencing, they were at the entrance of a long-abandoned tin mine. The grassy terrain sloped gently upwards to admit a circular tunnel held up with ancient wooden supports, like a hobbit's slum dwelling. It had once been boarded up, almost certainly with the boards that were now scattered in pieces on the ground near the tunnel mouth.
"They did this," said Adam, crouching to inspect the splintered wood with his third eye.
"Yeah, probably," said Victor, leaning on the nearest wooden support.
"No. Hang on."
Adam squinted, then pushed a few of the wooden pieces aside.
"They came through here, but they didn't break the boards off. Something mundane did that."
"Yeah, I'd have thought so." Adam glanced at his partner, who was completely motionless but for the occasional swipe of his thumb.
"Could you please switch to on-the-job mode?"
"Yeah, I totally agree." He swiped again and grimaced. "Ugh, Jake Hotblad's closed his Twitter account. What the hell is wrong with people?"
"Well, it was his own fault," said Adam, peering through the mine entrance and wiggling his head as if shaking excess sugar off a cupcake. "Come on, they're about 20 feet further down."
"Oh, don't pin it on him," spat Victor, as they made their way down the sloping tunnel, idly fencing with flashlight beams. "It's all these social justice warriors online that piss me off. They're just looking for excuses to lynch people."
"What was it he said? Shout out to all my niggers, noggers and shoggers?"
"So? He's black?"
"I think it's the shogger part that caused the offence."
He shone his flashlight down a side tunnel.
"Wow. People could really get lost down here."
"Yeah, other people probably would," said Victor, bored. "Which way now?"
Adam pointed. "Trail leads this way."
"What the hell happened to free speech? That's what I want to know," continued Victor. "Whatever happened to, I don't agree with what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it?"
"I don't think that applies to hate speech. Something's getting closer. It knows we're here."
"Hate speech? He was being friendly, for Christ's sake. Maybe if these screeching harpies spent their energy going after people who say the bad words and mean them, they might actually make a bloody difference." From somewhere up ahead, what sounded like a metal gate opened violently, smashing against a rocky wall with a clang that reverberated through the entire mine. Adam and Victor simultaneously adjusted their step to stroll towards the sound.
"It doesn't matter what his intention was if people were offended," said Adam,
slowing his pace a little to allow Victor to walk in front.
"He doesn't get to decide if they were offended or not."
Victor blew a little raspberry. "You know something? I've never heard of a single fluidic being personally offended by Shoggoth. I don't think they care. It's all online busybodies getting offended on their behalf. The only thing Wolfson ever said was that they prefer to be called fluidics. He didn't say anything about slurs."
"Wolfson doesn't speak for all of them," said Adam.
"He might. They're a hive mind."
"No, they're not. They're, like, a bit hive-mindy, but I think it's more complicated than that. 10 meters, just past the next turn."
"Either way," said Victor,
None of them are going to die of shame and fear because someone on Twitter said Shoggoth.
He stopped at the junction. In the tunnel ahead, a naked, vaguely humanoid creature lay in a sprawled crouch, skinny arms and legs twisted into an unnatural crab walk. It had no lower jaw, but its teeth were numerous and long enough to make up